This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC
105.3 FM, the sanctuary for independent media. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today we're going to be discussing the latest developments in Congressional District 19 with coverage from Tom Rowe at our sister station in WGXC. Then, Lavonia Mallory speaks with journalist and founder of the feminist blog Feministing, Jessica Valenti. After that, Grayson Gerlich speaks with Dana Wright and Holly McMahon about their local media production company, Riverway Media. Then, Labor Talk host and roaming correspondent Willie Terry brings you part two of Stephen Haimowitz's talk on racism and the law. And then we'll close out the show with Kat Jones, who is speaking with Cassandra in her ongoing series on the experiences of homeless people.
But first, let's start the show off with some rapid-fire headlines. Daniel Nellis, 45, of Oppenheim, was arraigned Thursday on the indictment and charged with second-degree murder and three charges of criminal possession of a weapon. Nellis was remanded to the Fulton County Correctional Facility without bail for killing the 21-year-old Michelle McVilla, a local Stewart's employee who went missing after her shift.
The 61-year-old man struck by a Colony police car should be released from the Albany Medical Center Hospital today, according to the Colony Police Department. Police said the injured, now identified as William Wade of Latham, was crossing Route 9 after getting off a CDTA bus near Fiddler's Lane before he was hit just after 6 p.m. on Wednesday. The man suffered a head laceration, among other injuries. Police have also stated the officer, now identified as Officer Gerald Shaw.
Improving patient safety during high-risk surgeries is the goal of Peak Neurophysiology Group, a new small business based in Troy. Peak Neuro, as it is known, plans to help MDs provide safer surgeries. The company's president and CEO, Michael Rowley, hopes their clinicians can raise the standard of care in the capital region. Michael Rowley describes his business as a, quote, intraoperative neurophysiological monitoring system.
Saratoga Springs parent Kara Rossetti is one of a number of parents calling on the district to add more school resource officers to their buildings. This is our reality now. School shootings are happening, mass shootings are happening, said Rossetti. This comes a week after the city council approved a resolution supporting strengthening security measures at schools. While some parents support the move to arm school guards, research on the effectiveness of armed guards in schools is mixed. Dr. Ron Avi-Astor, a University of Southern California professor of social work and education, said parents want armed personnel because it makes them feel better, but it often has the opposite effect on students and school staff. We have a lot of research, he says, on increasing the number of armed people in schools. It shows that long-term, it does not make the students or the teachers more secure. Over time, it makes students and teachers feel more like they are in a prison-like setting.
As part of a preventative measure, Albany fire officials, police officers, and code enforcement officers went door to door to educate people about fire safety in the late fall season. It's time when heat kicks on. Not only are we concerned about fires, said Chief Joe Gregory, we're also concerned about carbon monoxide. And that's it. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC, Hudson Mohawk Magazine, 105.3, The Sanctuary.
To learn more about this program and how to support The Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or intriguing pie recipes, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Better be sweet potato pie recipes.
Okay? I accept all pie recipes,
okay.
But do include sweet potato, please. The 19th Congressional District was the scene of one of the most contentious campaigns in the midterm elections. Tom Rowe filed this update from WGXC Radio in Hudson.
Tom Rowe with WGXC, and you're listening to the Congressional Report for New York's 19th District. For news about Representative John Faso, current Republican from Kinderhook who holds the position, and Antonio Delgado, the congressperson-elect. Currently, the 538.com website reports that Faso votes with Donald Trump's positions 89.2% of the time, the same as before the election.
Jimmy Valkin reports in the Wall Street Journal that Representative John Faso blames Democrats and the media for his election loss November 6 to Antonio Delgado. He said the media coverage of his campaign was, and I quote, grotesquely biased, end quote.
That was an apparent reference to many people calling ads run on his behalf by national Republican groups racist, which one local radio station pulls for that reason. While Faso's blaming of the media may sound like he was in step with Donald Trump, the president criticized Faso days after endorsing him on Twitter. Faso was one of eight Republicans who lost that the president blamed for not embracing his message. Faso said Trump was, and I quote, a big factor in generating the Democratic turnout, so I don't know that being more supportive in a public way would have changed the outcome in any way. It probably would have made it worse, end quote. Read the full story in the Wall Street Journal.
On November 14th, Faso voted for H.R. 6784, the Manage Our Wolves Act, which sounds like a bill everyone can get behind. But House Republicans inserted a line in the bill declaring, quote, the provisions of Section 7 of the War Powers Resolution shall not apply to House Concurrent Resolution 138, unquote. That effectively keeps American military forces in Yemen, even though that has not been authorized by Congress pursuant to the War Powers Resolution. So instead of a bill to protect wolves, this was a bill to keep the U.S. involved in Saudi Arabia's war with Yemen, where many war atrocities have occurred. The bill passed 201 to 187, with only six Democrats voting for it and 15 Republicans, but not John Faso, voting against. Since the election, Faso has been mostly silent on Twitter and his own website. Delgado has been posting photos from Washington, D.C., where he has been attending orientations and meeting other representatives. Faso did give one national interview this week with Bloomberg TV, where he again blamed Democrats and the media for his electoral loss.
Well, I guess the most direct question is the president right? Would you have won if you had embraced him more closely?
Actually, I don't think so. Our district is very politically divided, and since I was elected and the president was elected in 2016, the Democratic base has been truly energized, and we saw this throughout the last 2 years. So I've handled the issue of supportive of the president on this way. I've said I'll support him when I agree with him, and most of the time I did agree with him on policies, and I will not support him when I disagree with him. And that's clearly the case, and I think that's what my constituents expected me to do.
So what lessons do you think we should take, all of us, and particularly Republicans, from this midterm election, and particularly for people like you who come from blue states, who come from districts that might be more divided, they're not Trump base, as it were. What is the route for those people to get to Congress, to get to the Senate, given President Trump's leadership?
Well, I think you have to carve out your own identity, and you certainly have to have a clear, consistent philosophy that will appeal to swing voters and voters in blue states like New York. I think it's clear the president supported candidates in Indiana, Tennessee, North Dakota, for instance, and they did very well. But that is not the environment that those of us who run in New York or California or New Jersey, for instance, face. So I think we have to recognize the Republican Party needs to be a big tent, and we have to be accommodating to the local concerns and local interests that exist in those states, especially if you want to win. We can't just be a party that is closeted into certain narrow confines, either ideologically or politically around the country. That's a prescription for losing.
President Trump doesn't come across usually as a big tent kind of guy, if I can say that. He seems to be more somebody who excludes rather than includes. Is he really controlling? Is he leading the Republican Party at this point? When he first was elected, people said, not really. He's not even really quite a Republican. He was a Democrat for many years. But is he really solidifying his support within the Republican Party?
Well, I think there's no doubt the president has strong support in the Republican Party. And I've been pleased to support him on regulatory changes, on things like moving the embassy to Jerusalem, on ending the Iran deal, on standing up for the country to get our NATO allies to finally bear their share of defense costs in NATO. I'm all for the president. The president did a great job on renegotiating the NAFTA agreement that's helping our upstate dairy farmers. So there are many areas where I'm in agreement with the president. And I think that what we have to do is recognize that the tone sometimes is going to turn off some voters. And if we're going to win in 2020, we've got to address that.
So give some advice to people who are left behind in Congress after you leave. You've been there. You've been part of the decision-making, part of the legislating. What would you advise your fellow Republicans in the House in terms of working with Democrats? Are there some areas that you could see people coming together and moving legislation forward that the president would sign?
I do think so. I think that I was a member of the Problem Solvers Group. It's a bipartisan group of Democrats and Republicans in the House. We set forth some constructive approaches on how to fix the mess that's the Affordable Care Act and try to address some of the issues of premiums and deductibles being way too high. I think that's one area. And I also think infrastructure still remains an area where you can find some common ground with Democrats and Republicans. It's pretty clear the Democrats are going to come in. I expect they'll overreach. Their progressive left base in the party wants things that, frankly, are not going to be good for the country, single-payer system, for instance. So I think we have to address, find areas where we can come together as Democrats and Republicans and agree. It's not going to be my problem next year.
It won't be your problem. But you have the wisdom maybe we could help people. And looking backwards, do you think the Republicans maybe overreached when it came to repealing the Affordable Care Act? That was a big issue. You took a couple of runs at it, and it really put it on the agenda in a way that I think may have made some voters across the country concerned about their health care.
Well, I think we clearly didn't sell the plan to people in an effective fashion. And because of our Freedom Caucus in the House, we wound up reopening this argument over pre-existing conditions, which should never have been opened. In fact, our bill, I believe, protected everyone with pre-existing conditions, but the Democrats made it an effective issue to try to exploit that weakness that we had. And that was done, frankly, to try to appease the right wing and the Republican Party in the House, the so-called Freedom Caucus, to get their votes to pass that bill. And candidly, many of them didn't even vote for the bill. So I think that my recommendation is that people in our conference have to recognize that not everyone is coming from a district in Alabama or Texas or Utah, and we've got to have a set of policies that you can sell broadly in the country, especially if you want to win in places like New York and California and New Jersey, et cetera.
That was an update on Congressional District 19 by Tom Rowe, our sister station, WGXC Radio, located in Hudson, New York.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Jessica Valenti, called one of the top 100 inspiring women in the world, is a columnist for Medium and a feminist author. Her most recent book, Sex Object, a Memoir, was a New York Times bestseller. In 2004, Jessica founded the award-winning blog Feministing.com. Jessica's articles have topped the most read lists at New York Times, The Atlantic, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. She's also written for Salon, Bitch, Miss Magazine, and The Toast.
Once again, we have another segment of Reclaiming History right here at 105.3 FM, the sanctuary for independent media. I'm Livonia Mallory, and I have a very exciting guest on the line, Jessica Valenti. Thank you so much for joining us here on Reclaiming History. Tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and all the exciting work that you are doing.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on. So I'm a feminist writer. I have a weekly column at a site called Medium, and I am the author of multiple books. I think about six right now. I'm working on the seventh. And so the vast majority of those books, sort of the idea is to try to make feminist ideas and feminism a bit more accessible. My first books were really for a younger audience, for teenage girls and young women who maybe believed in feminist values, had feminist ideas, but didn't necessarily identify as feminists. And the hope with those books is to get them to identify as feminists. And now I'm working on a book, hopefully out in the next year or so, called The Misogynist, that takes a look at all the different kinds of misogyny in America right now and how it's influencing so much of what we're seeing happening in both politics and culture.
So tell my listeners a little bit about a recent memoir.
I did. In 2016, I published a memoir called Sex Object, and it's really interesting because it came out about a year before sort of Me Too started in earnest, but was very much in line with that conversation. And the memoir was essentially about the toll that sexual objectification takes on women's lives. And I wrote it because I wanted to sort of address the cumulative impact of things that happen to women, right? You know, we have a language, we have words and stories for experiences when women, you know, experience one really terrible thing, right? Or a particular trauma. But there isn't a conversation happening, or there wasn't at that point, about sort of the snowball effect of what happens to you as a woman, the emotional, the psychological toll of living in a sexist society. And that's really what I wanted to do with the book. And it was, it seems weird to say it was great to see the reaction to it, because it wasn't great. It was, you know, it was hard and difficult, but I got a tremendous amount of support after the book came out, and received a tremendous number of emails from women who felt like the book really spoke to them, and they related to it.
So in your memoirs, you discussed the value of acknowledging victimization, and in your words, the unwillingness to be victims, even if we are, doesn't protect us if we just cover up the wreckage, unquote.
Yeah, you know, part of what I was responding to, and I'll talk about the term sex object in a minute, but with the idea of victimization, part of what I was responding to was we were in this moment with feminism where everyone was talking about how strong they were, right? Like, I'm strong, and like, get it, girl, and you're doing all this great stuff. And like, and I understand it. It was a lot of language about empowerment. And I think that's great. And I understand that. But I think what was happening was that it was a sort of glossing over of how these things can really make you feel and impact your life. And I was guilty of it myself. You know, I'm online a lot. I deal with a lot of online harassment. And whenever I got like a threat or harassment, I would sort of make fun of it and pretend that I could just brush it off my shoulders, when in fact it was terrible. And it had a terrible impact on me. And I think that it's important, as we're having these conversations, as sort of sexual harassment and sexual assault have become part of the mainstream discourse, that we acknowledge that we don't necessarily get over it, that it is something that stays with us for a long time, and that there's nothing wrong with laying claim to the word victim. With the term sex object, it was interesting, because I knew when I decided to title the book that, I knew that there would be pushback. I knew that it would be controversial. And what I suspected would happen would be that certain readers, men in particular, or, you know, sexist men, would say like, oh, well, aren't you complimenting yourself? You think you're a sex object, right? Like, as if I was paying myself some sort of great compliment.
Right.
That wasn't the reaction. But what it failed to take into account was sex object is a thing. It's not a person, right? This is not some big compliment you're paying yourself when you say women have been objectified. And I think the fact that we think of this as a compliment is part of the problem.
Interesting. So, you know what, when you were talking about acknowledging the havoc that it affects women, their psyche, their emotional, I think about, you know, I'm the burn the bra generation. So I think about the song, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, right?
Yeah.
You know, this superwoman, which is the black feminist ethos, this black superwoman is snapping her fingers, and she's strong, and she's telling everybody off, and she's take charge.
Right.
And that is a detrimental place to be, because you're not a superwoman. You're a woman, you're a human being. And I think you're right. You do have to deal with it's sort of like a double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, you're strong, but on the other hand, you have been victimized, and that does affect you.
Right. We need to acknowledge, you know, that there's a vulnerability there. And I think, you know, for women of color in particular, this idea that like they need to be forever strong is dehumanizing. You know, it erases the sort of humanity and vulnerability that goes along with being a woman in a society who also has to deal with racism.
So in your recent article for Medium, you wrote, it's time to dispense with the myth of American sisterhood. Women are not a monolith, and women who supported Trump in the face of injustice, this will not change. I mean, what are you saying there?
Yeah, well, you know, this was in response to, we know in 2016, you know, the 52-53% of white women voted for Trump. And we saw something similar happen in the midterm elections, where a lot of the bigger races that Democrats were excited about in Texas and in Florida, we saw a really large percentage of white women voting Republican. And I think for the last couple of years, there's been this idea on the left that we can convince white female Trump supporters to change their ways, to flip to the other side, that if we point out the bigotry, the sexism, the racism, you know, the horrific family separation policy, that if we point out all of these things, that these voters will change their minds. And I understand why that's a compelling idea, but I think that it fundamentally ignores the fact that historically white women have enjoyed the benefits of white supremacy, have enjoyed the benefits of patriarchy in a lot of ways. And I think that this idea that they're flippable comes from this belief, mostly among white feminists, that they're somehow redeemable, that we can save them. And my sort of argument in this piece was, you know what, if you're still supporting Trump at this point, if you're looking at the family separation policy, if you're looking at the things that he says and the bigotry and the hate that he is sparking and inciting and the violence that he's inciting, if you can still support him after all this, you're a lost cause. And I think that our activist efforts would be better put towards places we know that we can help, like voter disenfranchisement, right, and voter suppression. There are things that we can do to battle back against the Trump administration that don't require us to talk to brick walls.
So let me see if I understand what you're saying, because, you know, I, you know, that's a lot to wrap your feminist brain around. There are white women who are women, but they are voting along the Republican Trumpian party line because they have benefited from white privilege or white supremacy. Is it white privilege or white supremacy? Because is there a difference?
I mean, I think it's both, right? Like, we all, like, every white person that benefits from white privilege. But I think that there's a difference between someone who would like that to change and someone who's enjoying it and doesn't want it to change. I feel like there is this idea that because these white female Trump voters are women, that they are somehow inherently less racist, or that we can change their minds more easily maybe than Trump's, you know, most vociferous white male supporters. And I don't think that that is true. These white female Trump supporters, if they're still supporting him, they are racist and they are a lost cause.
So Jessica, with all of these white women that are now voting for Trump, what does that leave us with? Who are the women that are left?
There are plenty. It's really interesting because, you know, as a white feminist, when you sort of talk about these issues and you mention all the white women who vote for Trump, inevitably you get a lot of left-leaning white women who say, "Hey, not me, not me." And you're like, "Of course not you. That's fine. I'm not talking about you." But there's plenty of things that we can do that don't require us to try to flip these Trump supporters, right? And I think that we saw what was happening in the midterms as a really good indication of that. We can reach out to voters who haven't previously been reached out to before. We can work on voter suppression. And I think if we put our money where our mouths are and work to elevate women of color to leadership positions, that's where we really start to win.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media. This is another episode of Reclaiming History. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
That was my interview with Jessica Valente about Sex Object, a memoir, and her discussion about liberal politics, women's voting, and the effects of being objectified by men. Special thanks goes out to my historical consultant, Angela Vinson, who helped me with this story.
For those of y'all just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory, and this is 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or puppies that you want to give away for free, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Okay, puppies. All right.
We're shopping for dogs.
All right. Riverway Media is a new local media production company. WOOC correspondent Grayson Garrick interviewed Dana Wright and Holly McMahon of Riverway about their creative economic visions.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright.
And I'm Holly McMahon.
Together we are Riverway Media, a new Troy-based video production company.
And our main focus is providing videos for local businesses or individuals who are looking to showcase, you know, their individual talents or what they have to offer to the public.
We also will be running all of our future personal film projects through Riverway Media as well.
Yep. Yeah. Our personal passion projects, documentaries, fiction films that will be funded through Riverway Media.
Well, thank you so much, Dana and Holly, for coming in and having an interview with us. So what brought you to Troy?
Well, when I was a senior at RIT up in Rochester, my senior thesis project ended up being a documentary about Troy and the revitalization that was going on in downtown. Because initially I wanted to focus on a Rust Belt city because I find them very interesting and kind of everything that they're going through, both from a historical and current standpoint. And it just so happened that my parents lived very close to Troy, so it's just very easy to, you know, work on that film from a logistics standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I had Holly do a lot of sound recording for me as a crew member. And while we were working in Troy, we just really just fell in love with
yeah.
the city.
Yeah, we definitely fell in love with it through the interviews, you know, especially when I was doing sound, I'm listening to the individuals that we were interviewing and just how passionate they were and how invested they were in being in the community and having a business that does like make a difference to the local people there. So yeah, I just really was inspired by their passion and their creativity, and I really felt like this was a place where we could really make a difference and try to do something really positive with our degrees. So
that's fantastic. So you guys both have film degrees from RIT, right?
Yes we do.
Yep.
And you guys have been graduated for a little bit now. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And welcome to Troy Region as well. Also congratulations on that. So you guys have personal projects and a website set up, right? Let's mm-hmm. talk about some of the things that you've worked on so far.
Yeah. So one of the videos on our website is the first thing I did that really has gotten any kind of recognition, I guess. I have a documentary called Pig about the intricacies of owning a pot-bellied pig. So yeah, I created that film my junior year. So yeah, we have that on our website, but that has gotten into several film festivals in the last couple of years, which has been a really eye-opening experience, like getting to meet so many new people and just the experience of being at a film festival. So that's why I have that included on our webpage, because it was my first documentary and it did get some recognition, especially in upstate New York. Yeah. Oh yeah, I recently screened at Watkins Glen Film Festival, and it did get picked for audience favorite for the short doc section, which was really nice.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And then the project I have up on the site is Rust Belt Recovery, which was my senior year thesis focusing on Troy's revitalization. I mean, that kind of kickstarted our whole thing
that
here.
That was the origin of why we ended up coming to Troy. So,
but with Rust Belt Recovery, I was looking to make kind of a positive documentary that really sold people on the community aspect of a Rust Belt city like Troy.
And you also produced a piece for iHeart and Why, right?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I made that the summer after I graduated. And that was really kind of integral in where we are now, because I did get a grant through that, and that was really, really useful in kind of getting to the point where we are now. So yeah, that video is also on our website, because that was produced as a finalist for a film contest through I Love New York. So yeah, that was a really invaluable experience.
You've got some both passion projects and documentary work, funded work, but coming into Troy, you're really looking to work in production for the local businesses here, from what I understand. Do you guys want to talk about your vision for that project?
Sure. So I've worked at various different production companies, so I'm well aware of how expensive video production can be, and it can definitely be very cost prohibitive for smaller businesses. So we're looking to kind of break that mold and offer a very small business friendly option for you know, places, you know, restaurants, shops, local places that, you know, maybe they want Facebook ad or like a video for their homepage that kind of tells people what they're all about. We work with small businesses to make sure we're very budget friendly with, mm-hmm. you know, what they're looking for, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that kind of goes into the why Troy question, because there's just every day there's a new business popping up, and it's there's like hardly any chains, you know, so it's just so much creative energy in one space and all these different people with really unique stories and really unique things that they are trying to share with the world. And we really appreciate that, and we wanted to showcase that, and again, in a cost-effective way that is ideal for small businesses.
For those businesses who may be really interested in this and are thinking to themselves right now, listening, like, oh my God, I can't believe that this opportunity is here. What should they be expecting if they come looking for your help with the promotional material?
Well, what they can be, you know, expecting from us is it's a collaboration. You know, it's not like we are going to do it our way and this is it. You know, it's, we want it to be a collaboration between the client and ourselves to, you know, come together and figure out what is it about your business that is unique, or whatever it is that we are making a video about. You know, it doesn't have to be a business. Whatever your passion is that we are trying to get out to the world, like, we will, you know, work with you on that and try to figure out what is, like, the best way to tell your story and get it out there.
It's very cool working with small businesses because they're just inherently more interesting and genuine than big corporations. So we see an opportunity to kind of harness that, you know, any sort of promotional material, because you're not just saying, look at this cool product or service that this person is selling or offering. It's also kind of showing people why they should also support this person, because it's very easy to pin like a business to a face, like a friendly face, that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, huge companies, everything feels kind of
artificial.
Yeah, I corporate guess. Fluffy, you know, just
yeah. We're just trying to get to the heart of what makes a person unique and what makes their business unique and why you should seek them out.
You're looking to tie the person to the storefront.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And pull a story out of what it is that they do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, if people don't, you know, some people don't want to be on camera and stuff, and if they don't want that, that's totally fine.
Yeah, no, it's all up to what the client wants. But in the end, yeah, we are just trying to get at, like, why this business is so valuable, you know.
When I was talking to you guys earlier, you said something that I thought was really interesting about your procedure, and that was that you guys are always looking to tell a story at some level. And whether that's a story of a small business here in Troy, or a story of caring for pot-bellied pigs, or anything else, there's a story to be found in anything. And I know that you guys are also looking to make personal projects through Riverway.
Yeah.
Are there things that you're working on now? What are some stories that are ticking in your brain right now?
I know over the winter, so soon, I want to start pre-production on another documentary, probably around the same length as Rust Belt Recovery, so like 20-ish minutes or so. And it's still super broad right now, so I need to spend a lot of time like really narrowing it down. But the general idea is I want to focus on the importance of the connection that humans have with nature. A lot of that, you know, you have humans are destroying the planet, that sort of thing. It's not necessarily a documentary about that, even though that's true and it's happening. But why is it so important to have urban green spaces in dense urban environments, that sort of thing? Because people need that sort of psychological connection to nature. And just in general, like, why are things like that so important?
Yeah, and I am, within the next year, I'm looking to produce 20 to 25 minute some type of narrative fiction piece, because that is mostly where I kind of excelled in school. I love documentaries, and I can't wait to work on another one. But yeah, I'm looking to produce a short fiction in Troy, because it's a beautiful area, and I really want to, I mean, it writes itself. I just want to do something with Troy.
Troy's so picturesque. There's a lot of great shots to be had, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys so much for coming in and letting me pick your brain a little bit about the stories that you're looking to tell and the businesses that you're looking to support here in Troy. For those businesses that were listening, or people that were listening and are interested in your services, why don't you give us your website one more time?
Yeah, that's riverwaymediatroy.com.
Thank you guys so much. That was Dana and Holly from Riverway Media coming in to speak with us here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
That was Grayson Gerlich speaking with Dana Wright and Holly McMahon of Riverway Media. Next, WOC Labor Talk host and roaming correspondent Willie Terry attended a seminar on racism and the law at the Albany Public Library on October 30th and recorded a presentation by attorney Stephen Hamowitz on racism in employment, schools, and voting. This is part two of that segment.
Again, legislature, courts, under the framework of law, what we think of law in this country as being a system to achieve justice. Obviously, there was segregation. It wasn't just the legislature and the courts, the president, President Wilson. Somebody asked me after last time, what did I mean when I said President Woodrow Wilson resegregated the federal government? What I mean is that all of the federal offices all over the country that were federal agencies, where African-American men and women had been in supervisory positions with the Woodrow Wilson administration, they were no longer in supervisory positions. They were fired, transferred, or demoted. And in the Woodrow Wilson administration, the bathrooms in all the federal buildings were resegregated. The eating facilities were resegregated, as they had been before the Civil War. Through the 1900s, when FDR is creating the way out of the Depression and is creating what ultimately becomes the middle class in this country, all of those big pieces of legislation were specifically intended and implemented to exclude African Americans. 1954, Brown versus the Board of Ed, the pivot, the first turn towards something that isn't explicitly and completely racist. But the small steps that have been taken are really what we're going to talk about, where that has led us today. We'll talk today about school segregation, affirmative action, where we are with voting, and the criminal justice system, or what I say is just the criminal system. Public school segregation, again, 1954, big turn in this country, whole world is watching, the U.S. government says, court, you have to rule in favor of abolishing separate but equal because we're an embarrassment in the world and we're fighting with the Russians over who's going to get the allegiance of these new emerging countries. The Supreme Court says, yes, segregation in public schools is unconstitutional. It says things like, well, we got to fix this with all deliberate speed. Nobody really knows what that means, and there's lots of questions about what the opinion means. In the next 13 years, from 1954 to 1968, the Supreme Court doesn't get involved in segregation issues. The lower courts, the federal courts in the South, get involved, and what happens is very, very little. Eventually, in 1968, in a case that comes to the Supreme Court indicates it's fed up, and it uses the term branch and roots. The segregation in this country will be eliminated in public school by its branch and roots. Beginning, however, in the early 1970s, and we'll talk in a minute about a whole lot of things that are happening at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 1970s. Remember, in 1968, the President Commission, looking into the urban uprisings, comes back with a report and says, called the Kerner Commission Report, two things. One is that it is white racism that has caused the situations that we now see as urban uprisings. It is almost always started by a police-citizen interaction, and that the society is moving towards two societies, separate and unequal. In the early 1970s, cases start going to the Supreme Court about the issue of school busing, which was the vehicle, excuse the pun, the vehicle through which in communities which had, in the South, done it by law, and in the North, done it by residential segregation systems and practices, had two communities living physically separate, and it was only buses that could make what they wanted, what the Supreme Court said, we want no longer a dual system, we want a unitary system. One system, you look at a school, you don't see a colored school or a white school, as they said, you see a school. The busing stuff actually works fairly well in the South, and it, where the courts are monitoring it carefully. And in fact, for a while, the South, school systems in the South are relatively integrated. Not so much the case today, and as we know, all across this country, and particularly in the North, there are virtually no integrated school systems. Segregation is as bad today as it was in the mid-50s. Part of what happens is the controversy created by busing, particularly in places like Boston, Detroit, Denver, and northern cities, becomes so vehement, and the political furor it causes becomes so intense that the Supreme Court starts getting the wind that this is not something that the country, quote, as they see it, can bear. They start pulling back. In cases involving Denver and then Detroit, they come up with this idea that because they think in the North segregation is de facto, meaning it's just the way people are. People tend to live with the people that they are most similar to. That's not because of government, and therefore you can't make those systems work together. There's a case that goes up in which the people in Detroit wanted to have a regional school system, not the city, but incorporate the city and the suburbs. And this was a big opportunity for the court to take the next step, and they swung and missed. They said, unless you can prove actual intent to discriminate, the court has no power to order a remedy like busing. That pretty much is the way it has evolved. The one thing that becomes important in more recent times, and that is in 2007, there's a case that comes up between, in two cities, Seattle, one in the north, Louisville, one in the south, voluntarily adopted a system to try to get schools actually integrated. It used a number of different factors, and it had a number of different incentives. But it was a system which included the potential that a child could be assigned to a school based upon his or her race. And Chief Justice John Roberts, in writing the decision for the majority, comes up with the phrase that has now become one of the simple, whatever you want to call it, one of the phrases that now gets used whenever the legal system is trying to deal with issues about race. What he says is, the way to end racial discrimination is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. This becomes what we now call in the legal system, the idea of being, the law should be colorblind. And we'll come back to that in a moment. In affirmative action, similar kind of development. Affirmative action, actually the term gets coined back in the John F. Kennedy, JFK era, when he sends out an executive order to all the government agencies and says, I want you to take affirmative steps to make sure that in hiring and promotion, you're not discriminating. That's what was called affirmative action at that point. Guarantee, show me, blah, 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 we're gonna monitor, you can't discriminate. LBJ sends the same kind of more expanded, more assertive memo as an executive order out later. It is, amazingly enough, Richard Nixon, who actually brings into existence what we would recognize as affirmative action. And it's not an absolute. It is, in fact, something he negotiated with an African-American minister in Philadelphia, Leon Sullivan. It's called the Philadelphia Plan, that every contractor who gets money from the federal government to do buildings, to provide services, to provide, you know, anything that the government's going to get, has to show to whatever agency they're working with that they have a plan, that they are going to try to determine a target that amongst the workforce in the contractor, a target of racial sort of reflection of what the community looks like, and they're going to come up with a timetable. There is no, you know, heavy-handed, I don't think anybody was ever punished for not actually meeting the targets, but people did make good faith efforts. Similarly with unions, which were well known as being, many unions were known across the country as places where nobody with from color was ever going to get a job, let alone a woman with, from who was a woman of color. All the unions that had contracts with the contractors that worked with the federal government, too, had to say they weren't going to discriminate anymore and they were going to set targets. This went on for a little while. It's this that begins to get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, back to this idea of, you know, de facto, there's this red, there's this, you know, reality, how people live, and since that's not explicit law making segregation, we're not going to have anybody try to do, make anybody do anything about it. The Supreme Court says in this employment area, the only time there can be affirmative action in a concrete, meaningful, measurable way is when there is demonstrable evidence, proof of discrimination in that workplace. So now the tide is kind of turning, and in now we're going to go back to the case that probably sets the tone that we are still living with today is Bakke versus the University of California, Davis.
That was Labor Talk host and roaming correspondent Willie Terry's coverage of Stephen Hamowitz's seminar, quote, Racism and the Law, part one of that segment is available on SoundCloud. Well, up next, we have another segment. WOOC correspondent Kat Jones sat down with Cassandra, a local artist, regarding her experience with homelessness. Kat is doing a series of interviews with people who are currently homeless or have experienced homelessness in order to combat common stereotypes about people who are homeless. Cassandra has a fresh perspective on what it's like to live on the streets. Even though it's hard, she sees her time there as an experience of liberation and growth. Because she went there to escape an abusive relationship, she learned to find resilience and strength and discovered that she is capable of taking care of herself.
So I'm talking to Cassandra now. Tell me about your experience with homelessness.
My experience with homelessness was actually a very positive one. I know sometimes that seems a little weird to say, but the reason why I became homeless was because I got out of a really bad relationship. So, and that was the first time I had like really actually been independent and like entirely in control and responsible for myself. And it was a really good time for me because I grew a lot as a person, and it made me realize the things that I could do, the things I was capable of, the things I didn't really need to have in my life. And I was kind of fortunate because I had a car, so I just lived in my van. So it was a little easier than being out on the street. I had some place to go. I was sheltered from weather and stuff. And I was only homeless for a few months. And like I said, it was a really good experience for me to grow and learned a lot about I didn't need to be with someone, not just romantically or emotionally, but like physically. I could be by myself and like be okay. And that was a really growing experience for me to go through that.
Nice. So yeah, that is a different perspective. What do you think the most positive thing that you experienced when you were homeless was?
The most positive experience was, like I said, just learning that I could do it. I had kind of been in this bad relationship, and like he kind of made me think that like I couldn't do things anymore. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do that. I wouldn't be able to be on my own. He straight up told me, like, you'll never be able to find anyone who can take care of you, or you won't be able to do this. And like seeing that, like, I can do it. I know I can. I'm doing it right now. Like, kind of gaining my own confidence back. And it felt really good to just like feel that and like be like, yeah, this is proof. I'm doing it. I can do it. I'm okay.
Yay. Were there challenges along the way, though?
Oh, definitely. There are a few really hard nights. There's some nights being hassled by the cops, and trying to figure out what to do with that. And those moments where it kind of did feel really, really lonely. And I try to stay sober for most of that. And for a lot of it, I was. But there are some nights where I couldn't stay sober. And drinking and thinking all those same nasty thoughts you think. And so there are a few hard nights of just actually being alone and realizing what being alone is. And it's like, I have to be okay with myself if I'm going to do this. So just having to reteach myself to be okay with myself.
I know a lot of people are just, you know, not that judgmental, but I've been hearing lately there are people around Albany especially that really kind of look down on people who don't have a place to live. What would you say to them?
I'd say you can't judge. Like, if you've never been in a situation like that, you don't know the full story. It's not just because someone doesn't know how to take care of themselves. There's so many things that could lead someone to be homeless. And a temporary homeless, long-term homelessness, like, you just never know. And it's not fair to try to judge someone just from one little piece of their story if you don't know the full picture. So just try to keep an open mind and realize it honestly could happen to anyone. There are so many reasons why someone can become homeless, and you can't really judge.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you want to tell me about your experience?
There's some humor you can find, and you kind of have to if you want to mentally and emotionally survive, I guess. But there are some, like, really unique stories you can have, and there are some really, just really cool situations you could find yourself in that you might not otherwise find yourself in. So just always keep an open mind, you know.
Nice. Thank you so much.
That was new Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Kat Jones speaking with Cassandra about her experience of homelessness. Mm. It's a good story.
Yeah.
So guess what, guy?
Is it that time?
It's that time.
Oh.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Our engineer tonight was Jack Massaroni. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 FM is produced by local volunteers just like Kat and Mr. Massaroni.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at mediasanctuary.org or just stop by our weekly meetings here Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. That's 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.